dear brothers and sisters, this is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. And as history is a testament, and furthermore both friend and enemy have testified openly, Imam Ali alayhi salam was not tainted with any vices, unlike so many others who surrounded him and opposed him. He had a perfect faith in Allah, and so he acted according to his belief. Imam Ali alayhi salam was a lantern of guidance in his time, where the sunnah of the Holy Prophet had begun to be forgotten. Yet Imam Ali remained steadfast on the path of the pure Muhammadan Islam, like a solid, unshakable fortress in the middle of a great wild storm.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: ما كذبت ولا كذبت ولا ضللت ولا ظلمي.
I have neither spoken a lie, nor have I been told a lie. I have neither deviated, nor have I been made to deviate from it.
Dear listeners, this is To My Brother, and we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, humbly at your service, speaking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, alhamdulillah, it is such a beautiful persona to be speaking about indeed. We find that one of the very beautiful aspects of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, something that, you know, every single human being can in one way or the other really benefit from and really move forward and have progress and development in their life, is this faith that Imam Ali alayhi salam had, and more specifically the faith that Imam Ali alayhi salam had in the Almighty Allah. We find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he at one time said that even if the covering, meaning the veils of the facts of the faith, are uncovered for me, this will by no means increase my current conviction. So just to repeat that, he says that even if the coverings of the veils are uncovered for me, this will by no means increase my current conviction. So meaning that the conviction and the faith and the iman and the belief of Imam Ali alayhi salam was to a certain extent that if all of these veils of doubt and are removed from his face or from his eyes, that he is at such a high level that his conviction wouldn't increase. It's a very powerful statement. I mean, you know, the more you think about it, it means that he is at the peak of conviction. He is the peak of yaqeen. He is at the peak of his faith in the Almighty Allah. to the point where he says that, listen, if these veils of the material realm were to be removed from my eyes, and that he sees the ultimate reality the way that it is. Really, I think the more I try to explain it, the more difficult it becomes to explain, because it's such a profound statement. But this amount of faith is what really motivates an individual, and it gives support to an individual, and it fuels an individual to be able to do the great things that they do, or the great things that they can do, right? If you want to achieve something great and something amazing, you have to have some kind of a support structure behind that. You need a motivator, you need something to fuel you, that spark to get you moving and get you going and get you running. And this is what that primary and that fundamental motivator is that faith in the Almighty Allah. The stronger our faith in Allah, our belief in Allah, our trust in Allah, our love in Allah, you know, the more we're going to be able to do out of life, and the more we can do life. It is really in the trials and tribulations and difficulties and calamities and tragedies that every single one of us face in our life. If we have that faith in the Almighty Allah, only and only then will we be able to surpass and pass and come out victorious from these trials and tribulations of life. A very thought-provoking lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام، چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر
دینی، human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الله سبحانه وتعالى in chapter 3 of the Quran in verse number 33 makes an announcement where he says إن الله اصطفى verily God has chosen Adam and then Nuh and then the family of Abraham and then Imran على العالمين over the rest of the people in the world. When you look at this verse of the Quran, you come to realize that all the human beings have been created by Almighty God, but they are not equal in the eyes of God. As far as their status is concerned, you know, when it comes to the prophets of God, the messengers of God, those who represent Him in conveying His message, they are at higher, you know, status than other human beings. I would like to take this opportunity to actually talk about the special status that God has given to Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet. Let me, you know, just read to you two out of so many narrations, authentic ones that we have from the books of the Sunni Muslims. One is from Abdullah ibn Abbas, when somebody asked him, can you say something about Ali to us? So So it seems this is the days, latter days, when Ali was no more alive. And so Abdullah ibn Abbas says, let me narrate to you a saying of the Prophet. Inna Rasulullah amara bil abwab al-shari'a fil masjid fasudda. He says, one day the Prophet gave the command that all the doors opening inside the mosque, fasudda, it should be, he ordered it to be closed. Illa babu Ali, except the door of Ali. فَإِنَّهُمْ وَجَدُوا مِنْ ذَلِكَ. Others who were told to close their doors, they felt a little bit bad about it. And so when the Prophet heard about all this complaint, he actually gathered them in the mosque. And he gave a speech there. Different narrations gave, you know, different parts of it. But it must have been a very brief speech. This is the basically the main part of it, where he says, he's now addressing the Muslims. He says, بَلَغَنِي أَنَّكُمْ وَجَدْتُمْ مِنْ صَدِّ أَبْوَابِكُمْ وَفَتْحِ بَابِ عَلِيمٍ. He says, I've been told that some of you feel bad that I have closed your doors opening inside the mosque, and I have allowed the door of Ali to be opened. وَإِنِّي وَاللَّهِ مَا سَدَدْتُهُ مِنْ خَضْلِ نَفْسِ. The Prophet says to them that, by God, I have not closed any door by my own will. Inna ala abdul ma'mur. I am the servant of God. I was told to convey the message and I conveyed the message. Umirtu bi shay'in fa'altu. I was commanded to do something and I did it. In at-tabi'i illa ma yuha ilayya. The Prophet says, I don't do anything but what is inspired and revealed to me by Almighty God.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق. تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، مجدهی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
From Ontario,
now back to our story.
What is it?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sassy. He's a
the Spotlight
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. As the Israeli regime continues to break its ceasefire agreements in both Gaza and Lebanon, anti-occupation leaders reiterate that resistance is the only way to confront Zionist aggression. What happens when guarantors of the agreements are also part of the problem? Do the Israelis want full-scale wars again? Well, the Secretary General of Hezbollah says surrender is never an option, and the resistance will not disarm. What lies ahead for the region? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Zeid Marchand, international law expert and geopolitical analyst out of Geneva. And Badru Sabeti, activist and political analyst out of London. Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in London. And Batul, the Israeli regime is currently breaking two ceasefire agreements. I mean, do you think that this is overall part of the regime's strategy to basically agree to the ceasefires in hopes that global attention to its crimes would become less, while at the same time continuing with its killings?
Yes, good evening to you, Marzia, and to your guests and all your viewers. It's not necessary that the policy of the Israeli occupation entity is necessarily matching that of America. At the end of the day, it is America that imposed the ceasefire in both countries. As the Israeli occupation entity, as we know, it wishes to move as it wills. And we see that practically the ceasefire is not a reality in both Lebanon and in Gaza, in the sense that it's continuously being broken. And actually, the Israeli occupation entity is emboldened in many ways because it knows that right now, in this current phase, the resistance will not per se enter into a direct open war with it, because it's not in its interest to do so, as it is restructuring and recuperating itself in what is now just one pit stop within a much broader and longer battle in this region to ultimately liberate it. So I believe that the Americans support a kind of negotiation under fire. That's their current strategy right now. It is one of closing the direct open wars. Without necessarily having that open war, it wants to achieve what could not be achieved, essentially, within 2 years of direct open war, whether that's in Gaza or, as we know, last year in Lebanon for those 66 days. So the Israeli occupation entity is fulfilling its interests to a minimum extent at a time in which it knows that the resistance won't respond. But ultimately, Israel cannot go outside of the American dictates in causing an all-out war. If it wants to do that, then it has to get the American position ultimately. And we've been seeing a series of escalations since the ceasefire last year on the 27th of November. The escalation that occurred last month with the assassination of the chief of staff of the resistance in Lebanon. And it must be said that the resistance right now, its lack of response shouldn't be mistaken. Of a willingness to respond to the entity ultimately is preparing for something much greater, and that is for the next war. And that would be like this current war. I believe, you know, this current war is not, you know, closing these directives more than opening doors.
So, that's true. Are you saying basically that the ceasefire was forced upon the Israeli regime by the Americans, and right now the Americans have given them a way that they can basically continue their aggression, but have the other side abide by the ceasefire, or what exactly are you saying?
Right, so one thing is that a limit to the extent in which Israel is transgressing. So America is not transgressing, as long as there's no reaction from the other side. But ultimately, it is playing the violence here, because what constitutes an aggression so large, such as to start an So this is a different point. America's ideal is negotiations under fire. It wants to pressure the resistance and get the resistance to a point of disarmament where Israel fails to do so through a direct-driven war. And that is to plan the government in Lebanon against the resistance. But it's quite hard to do so, or let's say the Lebanese government doesn't exactly have any arsenal to do so when Israel's transgressions are so ongoing and continuing. So this is an interesting point over here. But what's clear is that Israel, through its direct wars both in Gaza and Lebanon, has failed to achieve what its primary goal was, and that's to disarm the resistance and achieve this quote-unquote nuclear peace project. So that has clearly failed. America's thinking, what is the next option? Let's address new strategies, and that's trying to give an entitlement to an unlearned existing international stabilization force to disarm the resistance in Gaza, to locate the towers,
I'm waiting for Saeed Maaz to join us. I mean, when we look at that tool, oh, Saeed Maaz, I have you. Can you hear me? Okay, I think we're still having some audio difficulties. Saeed Maaz, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I saw nodding of the head, so that was a good sign. Thanks so much for joining us. When we look at the overall situation that is taking place, whether we're talking about in Gaza or we're talking about in Lebanon, we get to the point we have those guarantees of the ceasefires. How complicit is it, Saeed Maaz, do you see these guarantors? What should they be doing and what is not happening right now as Israeli aggression continues in both places?
Well, thank you for having me. Sorry for that technical difficulty earlier. The thing is, you know, these guarantors need to be able to do the basics, and sometimes they're not even able to do that. And that's what brings a lot of these questions into these ceasefires, and why some commentators have, again, called it UC's and I will continue to fire. And that's how Israel has changed the development around there. I just came from Doha Forum, where this was being discussed, and, you know, there never was a time to discuss about humanitarian aid and access to humanitarian aid as a conversation piece of negotiation. This was supposed to be something that's given anyway. The fact that you have guarantors that are discussing this as a potential negotiating piece clearly shows the one level that's on this side in favor of Israel. There should be no question as to these basic humanitarian needs. And so what guarantee can we get from people who are negotiating humanitarian access? This is really appalling to begin with, the starting point. And if you even knew the British scholar who actually put the design for this, they're apparently using his label, he even came out and condemned America, saying that it's incorrect to use it in this manner. So even the academics and people in the international community who work in humanitarian affairs clearly see what these deals are for. They're never in reality for what they're supposed to be, which is a ceasefire. They don't have the basics of even that. So the guarantors are one-sided. We do not have parties to this, these agreements or these ceasefires that want a serious end to the violence and to put serious restrictions on Israel, who happens to be the main person in this entire, either ceasefire in Gaza or Lebanon, that seems to be violating that.
that thing which you said, Maz, the consequences. I mean, so far, we haven't seen the consequences, but at the same time, people continue to be killed, both in Gaza and Lebanon. Let me also add to that, the West Bank even. So, what are the consequences? And at the end of the day, if there are no consequences, then tell me about what exactly it means to have these type of agreements and the guarantors.
I hate to sound very bleak, but that your question is very a striking one, and that's something that us academics, we're really looking at into now. But for example, this idea of lack of humanitarian access with implications by the Israeli authority is essentially genocidal intent. Amnesty International came out last month with a very brazen report suggesting that just because of the ceasefire, the continued prevention of humanitarian aid access to people in need is a genocidal intent. And that's what it is. Israel is in this Eretz Israel project. They want to take over the Mitzrayim. Netanyahu has been blatant about this repeatedly. Smotrich and others who have been allies, they make it very clear that this is what they want. Now, what sort of consequences? I mean, in the Amnesty International Court, for example, they're talking about bringing ICC charges, which we know have already happened with Netanyahu and Lavan. But so far, no real meaningful action. I mean, just right now, the ICC had a gathering in which they were speaking to court. Some of their judges have been sanctioned. I just met Francis Galvin, and can you imagine a U.S. rapporteur who's just reporting the truth has getting sanctioned, and she has difficulty just functioning basically. So there are a few of us who are obviously in the international humanitarian affairs and human rights, but again, countries have to step up, and particularly Muslim countries seem to have gone toe-to-toe with Mr. Trump. This is great, okay, but they need to be able to push back and get some serious guarantees. And if you cannot get guarantees of basic human rights, basic humanitarian access, the prevention of continued warfare which Israel continues to do, this is not a ceasefire, this is a continuance of war.
What does it mean? I mean, as a previous guest said, it's a continuation of war. It sounds good. We're talking about possibilities and of course, that there should be guarantees to allow the humanitarian supplies to enter. But at the same time, as we're speaking, the people continually, they're dying. They're being killed. They're being starved to death in Gaza. I mean, the head of the Hamas, Khalilah Haya, has said that armed resistance and bearing arms remains the right of the Palestinian struggle against the Zionist occupation, obviously stressing that resistance is the only way and they will not lay down their weapons. What are your thoughts about that comment at this point in time? Who was it meant for and what does it mean exactly, your perspective?
This is the line of resistance, not admiring that occupation. Resisting is an inherent right. International law gives that very right. It's a very unusual phenomenon, but actually there are spontaneous reactions to every action. So that is the right that occurs actually within the phenomenon of nature's power and even. Like every action leads to a kind of reaction. So when the extent of the possibility of practicing aggression, the atrocities that you've just mentioned, and actually complete transgression of the human rights occurs, it's very natural to see this kind of resistance. The legitimacy of that resistance is garnered due to the very action of the action. So what we have all the kind of aggression, occupation, complete transgression combined, you know, so it is not natural for there to be no resistance, you know, based on the extent of transgression that we've seen, but you mentioned the superpowers that are here and the guarantors. Ultimately, what happens to them is this is not securing the rights of the people or their state of being or the allowing of international aid or any of that. What happens to them for the region? Not least to their interests. So right now they don't want it to turn into a war. Or they don't want major instability right now. But they can that you know what it wants right now within a certain list that we described, and that is that Israel's targeting of the resistance parties in Lebanon should be such that it doesn't go beyond select targets and the interests, because ultimately they want these negotiations to continue while under pressure. They allow people to do what it wants without proving we talk for us as the key with one word. That is, we cannot, do not wish to mention Israel. Same word, same prayer. 2017, even though this isn't London, this is us. We cannot control Israel. I see it can do whatever it wants. It can turn even into a serial war where we negotiate and concessions are given, all the concessions of the world. You do accept what Israel wants, but at the same time, we can target every Muslim people in the country and completely strip away your sovereignty and maintain our very presence and occupy your land, essentially. So that means that there's been zero interference. Opposite of what you're saying, it's actually justifying everything that Israel can do, and you know, with a press of a button, it can stop Israel from action. What Israel does is attack Lebanon, which is being used as a pressure against Lebanon to do what Israel failed to do. So if Israel fails to disarm the oppressors, then the Israeli attacks are used to pressure Lebanon to get it to disarm via the government. We know that the resistance of given its weapons to South of the Libani, that's something that the Secretary General has come out and said, and I've read from statements from the UN to that effect. So we're going to first things from an all-out war to negotiations at the final. That's essentially what we're seeing right now in the region compared to the status quo. And that is all because the open war does not reach its goal, and that is because the resistance and is still strong, aka it's not been defeated.
Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sheikh Naim Bassem, has said that talking to the Lebanese, that those who are helping the enemy, to look at what has happened to Syria and understand what the enemy wants for Lebanon, which is an entity under the regulatory control and destruction of Lebanon. Your thoughts, what can the Lebanese, what should the Lebanese learn from Syria?
No, absolutely. I think that's well said, that they're going to occupy and teach Lebanon. Let's not be wrong about it. That's exactly the plan. That is Eretz Israel. That is working towards Eretz Israel. And that's something that's been very clear from the Israeli agenda. So Lebanese people look at their country for the last time with those borders, because that's something part of that border Israel's going to take. And then once they eat that, they're going to eat the rest. What's happening in Syria, where they've taken all this land and they're not going to come back. This idea, they can see this idea of one minority playing against another minority. And this is the strategy that Israel's been used over there. They've supported the Christian minorities in the communities, where in actuality those Jews were the very first people to be part of the rebels. So it's kind of just using one party to another and to get their hands on it. And Lebanese people need to realize that, you know, you have to come together. This is a defense of the sovereignty of your nation. And what's really sad is that, what I think is very important that you see my colleague mentioned, let's be clear here. Hezbollah goes away today, Hamas goes away today, the resistance is still not going to exist. Because the issue behind why these things exist, those inequities, those still exist, and people can raise their banner to exist against the Israeli state. And that's something that they said that people need to realize that that's not going to happen. And just one last point for you, even that what we see out of Europe, talk about your free speech, look what they're doing to Russia. I mean, they unilaterally just froze all the assets of Russia just last week, right? And the ceasefire hasn't even occurred. So, I mean, when we talk about tools that are available for these very countries, we talk about open support Palestine, we recognize Palestine, it's time to actually do more. And if you are doing it in certain cases in Ukraine, and this sort of hypocrisy and double standard is actually clearly destroying the international legal framework as we have said. So, for God's sake, please stop doing this. And for Muslim countries to step up and follow pursuit, because in our region, the Arab countries need to come together and realize that just like recently the EU is dealing with the Ukrainian issues, the Arab countries need to come together more solidly and give a quiet response that we're not going to do business with Israel. Even those who signed Abraham their ambassadors and those Christians until we get some serious feedback. There are things that practically can happen in those if they have the backbone.
Yeah, that's a big head question. But back to, I mean, Sheikh Naim Bassem reiterated that Hezbollah defends and will persevere and stand firm. And surrender, he says, means nothing. Resistance opens the path to possibilities. Wait, your thoughts on these statements, and in general, general, your overall prognosis of what lies ahead for the Lebanese resistance in general in Lebanon right now, with a very, very volatile situation right now. Your thoughts?
Especially what Champagne over here is saying is that the resistance parties should really be considered for the government a source of strength and needs to be understood to the will of the government that needs sovereignty and stability. So that we are in a much real the government is unable to defend great aggression because the Lebanese government is unable to arm itself in a way where it can defend its sovereignty because America it controls what it is and it does not allow. So suppose tomorrow the Japanese government was to take hold of the resistance weapons, we would see a similar situation as in Syria. And that's why we see radio push and global radar explosions across those people. So basically, Lebanon under the American currency piece is not allowed to be sovereign. And so this is where the system of the Senate basically fills the gap. The diplomacy I'm seeing right now is not being used as a tool for liberation as it should be. That is a tool to realize that sovereignty rather than being used to blackmail the Lebanese state to give up the system arms and strip them of its sovereignty. So what the government is trying to do is to prevent the government from giving up 40% of the brain in the claim that that is in its interest and really to join it so that it can be a support front in fighting this.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iwan Radio, and I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Then it's time for Around the World with Reporters. Listen to fascinating reports from all over the globe as reporters tell us what's happening in their corner of the world. Our radio productions feature will again follow after this. Stay with us for this hour.
This week on the Moscow Report, it's one of the most important interviews I've done on this show. It's with the highly respected German journalist Hussein Doğru, who for the last couple of years has focused his work on the horrors that we've seen in Gaza and the pro-Palestine protests in Europe. For his work, the European Union some time ago decided to sanction him. It's the first case of its kind, effectively taking away some of the most basic human rights of one of their own citizens due to their journalistic work. Interestingly, the apparatus they've used to take away his rights are the anti-Russia sanctions, even though there's no evidence that he has any links to Russia. He has had some support from important European luminaries like the MEP Claire Daly and the former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, who see his case as fundamental to the future of human rights and free expression in Europe. And I do believe that it is important for journalists inside and outside the mainstream to stand up for his case and not let it to stand. Hussein, thank you so much for joining me. Now, first of all, what is your situation? You've been sanctioned by the European Union. Your bank account's been frozen. There's a travel ban. What is that like, first of all? How has it impinged on your rights and your ability to work and live?
So, first, thank you for having me. Being sanctioned as a European citizen within Europe is being in an open prison. You're stripped of all your rights, you're not allowed to work, you're not allowed to earn any income, support your family. You're not allowed to leave the country which you live in, or even freely move as a European citizen within Europe. And I think the most hard or more extreme part of it is that my family is suffering from that, even though they have nothing to do with it, because the situation which I'm in, financial situation, but also legal situation, affects me as well. Right now, the situation with me is that nobody can assess, not even the German government, which is responsible for executing the sanctions on me, because I'm in Germany. Even they don't know what the legal status of me is, because sanctions are designed for foreign people living not in Europe, but I'm living in Europe, so it is a black hole right now for all of us, for my family, for me, and for my children.
Sum up your case, first of all. I mean, you're a German journalist, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the last couple of years you've mainly been focused on the horrors that we've seen in Gaza and covering protests in Germany against what is happening in Gaza. But you seem to have been sanctioned under anti-Russia sanctions. That seems very strange. Explain that.
To be able to understand that, I think we need to remember that Germany is not theoretically but practically in war. State of mind is in a war situation and actively supporting a war in the Middle East, which is the genocide against Palestinians. So if a country is in a war, it is fighting a designated enemy outside of its country, but also inside of its country itself, which is its own population, which are the critical journalists, which are people like me, who are highlighting the crimes that our government here commits by violating international law, by supporting genocide, supporting politicians who have international arrest warrants. And if you do so, then that's government, which is fighting effectively two front wars, is trying to suppress every single political voice within its own borders to shut down any opposition. And to be able to do that, they labeled me as a Russian disinformation secret operative here in Germany, because their legal argumentation is by highlighting the situation of Palestinians in Gaza who are suffering a genocide, by interviewing Palestinian resistance factions like Hamas, like PFLP, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, I would contribute to the disinformation campaign of Russia.
I saw Claire Daly, the famous Irish MEP, talking about your case in Parliament, and as she said, it seems that pro-Palestinian activism in Europe is seen, as you say, as a Russian destabilization campaign. I mean, I think it's more likely the horrors of the slaughter of children that the Europeans are seeing on their TV screens is why Europeans are taking to the streets. But they seem to suggest with your case that it's somehow Russian destabilization.
That goes far back about what happened within Europe since 2012-2015, when the whole conflict around in and outside of Ukraine happened. The European Union put some laws into place which enabled the German government to do all of these things. What they technically did is the European Union militarized information, militarized journalism, which are not aligned with their core narratives, which they openly say so. Maybe you heard of the ESA Act, Digital Services Act of the European Union, which started around 2018, which said disinformation is undermining the European project, questioning the democratic legitimacy. And by saying so, they started to target journalists, which are not for questioning the politics of the European Union. And that turned into like a repression machine in Europe, which is used especially since 2015-16 with the Russia label. Because as you know as well from your journalism, governments push illegal or authoritarian laws, and there is kind of fear within the society. In German society, European society, is in fear created by the European Union. Russia is going to attack us, or mass operatives are within European borders.
Because what is your, just asking, what is your views on Russia? I saw an article you wrote recently in which you referred to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which isn't the words that the Russian government or Russian media would use about what is happening in Ukraine. I know you're critical of the militarism that's happening in NATO, but you don't seem to have been campaigning very much, too much. You've been focused on other issues. You don't seem to be pushing Russian disinformation very much.
No, I mean, my view on Russia, which I express on several occasions, and also in my work as well, is I see Russia like I do see European countries, as well as two sides of it, various blocs who are fighting for political capital interests right now in Ukraine. That was always my view. This is always what I critique.
So you've been sanctioned for essentially under this Russian sanction regime, but have they given you any evidence that you are living in Russia?
If you look at the sanction paper, which is public, it says, as you also mentioned at the beginning, sanctions in context of the 17 Russia sanctions. Then the explanation in that paper is by news coverage on primarily pro-Palestinian protests, crackdown on pro-Palestinian protests here, covering a university occupation, which was for them apparently dangerous to cover that, and covering violent protests within the European Union, that was categorized as creating discord and destabilizing or threatening the unity of European Union. But later, we got the evidence pack of the European Union, which was something completely else, which is critical opinions, my private opinions, but also as Red Media, my media outlets, about the German politics, about historical facts that we publish. One example, this is a historical fact, that former SS Nazis, SS commanders, SA commanders from Hitler fascism after the Second World War became commanders or generals within NATO and had very high ranking positions. The European Union categorized that as wrong and disinformation, or a critique of me that German journalists do not cover the repression against me was categorized as disinformation and used to sanction me as well. So it's two different layers, three different, accusing of being Russian, explaining with Palestine, but the evidence indicates that the German government was not happy about my reporting critique with their politics.
And so they've just tried to find, in intelligence speak, it's called throwing spaghetti at a wall. It seems that they're, see whatever sticks. It seems that they're just trying to push anything on you without any real evidence.
No, there is no real evidence. Technically, what they present as evidence is disinformation itself, and historical revisionism. I think it was McNamara, the European MEP, who said, by fighting disinformation, we're becoming exactly what we are fighting against. And this is today happening. And I think Europe is not doing a mistake, it's not a glitch in the matrix, or it is not a stupidity of certain political, I think it's a political line today that information needs to be controlled, critical voices need to be shut down or pressed, even if it's journalists now today. Step by step, the liberal bourgeois democracy that we know needs to be dismantled by those who are upholding that, because today it is a barrier, it is an obstacle for them to push their militaristic agenda, their Rearm Europe project, and the entire shift to the right within Europe as well. And the only barrier for that is their liberal democracy. Now it needs to step by step demolish. This is what is happening in Europe.
So I want to ask you something very important, perhaps the most important question today. I've seen you actually sent me a document by a former European court judge. It's a recent document in which basically they make clear that the sanctions regime, particularly against you, because you're a German citizen, you're not Russian, is actually against European law. Now, I've read the document, it's all in legal speak, but it makes clear basically what anybody, even without a legal background, should intuitively be able to understand. That taking away a citizen's rights without any due process is quite clearly not only against European law, but against the founding basis of European civilization.
Yes, the report mentions several elements. The first is that the European Union, by sanctioning a European citizen, stripped off his all of his rights, which he or she has within the European Union, which is freedom of movement, freedom of expression, and the right to technically survive, to be able to work. So these rights are stripped off. I'm not allowed to exist. Just to make it maybe more concrete, people think about sanctions, assets are frozen, as I would have like millions now in my account. I would definitely not be here, and you're not allowed to travel, but it goes further to that. So what is happening with me specifically is that the right of existence is gone, the right as a European citizen is gone, as Janusz Korupakis mentioned as well. You're non-person, and I think that is the punishment itself. And if you go also further and read in this report, it also says, and for that you need to understand sanctions like the European Union describes it, about to bring a change in your behavior. And later they say it is not about non-illegal behavior. It is about non-illegal legal behavior that we want to change. So we don't need to do anything wrong.
So if you think, if you suddenly gave up your work, if you announced on X or whatever, in your social platforms, that I am giving up my work, my journalistic work, do you think they'd just take the sanctions off?
I think they would. I don't think they would. Like, first of all, I would not do it. I did nothing wrong. I used my rights, which they are supposed to uphold, first of all. Second, I do not think they will reverse the sanctions, because the sanctions itself is illegal, because there is no disinformation, there is no wrong information, there is no support for the Russian government that is in Ukraine or whatsoever. I mean, the legal report highlights that as well, that the problem is not the person, the problem is the mechanism that Europe created, that now a certain intent, a certain different opinion can be now punished without judicial control. That's also what they critique. It is an extrajudicial process.
Because if your case is allowed to stand, if what's happening to you is allowed to stand, essentially now the European Union can strip citizens of their rights. So essentially putting across ideas that they don't like. On any subject, and we've hardly even spoken about Ukraine. Like millions of European people, you've been angry and through your journalism, advocating, if you like, for Palestinians or right to protest over Palestinians. And that's essentially why you've been sanctioned. So if your case is allowed to stand, the sanction means the European Union can strip anybody of their rights without any due process.
Exactly. Like, my case right now is a precedent case. As my lawyer said, you're holding the Pandora's box closed. And if you leave that now, that Pandora's box is open, and it's doomsday in Europe. And we can feel that this fear is working in Germany, because there is an extreme self-centered